Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's March 10th, 2017 program, Cruelty to Women Here and Now. My name is Juan Carlos Valle, City Club President. Support to the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including Evans, Elder, Brown, and Supert, a Eugene commercial real estate company dedicated to selling, leasing, and developing office, retail, investment, and industrial properties, and assisting clients in completing 1031 tax exchanges. Our program today looks at the extent of abuse to women in the local region and what resources are available to the people affected. We will examine a costly social, financial, and moral problem for our community. This is a problem that is intolerable. All citizens pay for it. All citizens suffer its consequences. Abuse of women is a cause of homelessness, lost work activity, poor performance by children in school, high cost of police actions, high crime and healthcare statistics, and many lost lives. Consider these sobering numbers. In the U.S., a woman is battered every 15 seconds. In Lane County, over 9% of the area's homelessness population cited domestic violence as a primary reason for the homelessness. One in five college women reported attempted rape during the college years. Men perpetrate the majority of violent acts against women, and almost two-thirds of all rapes are committed by someone who is known to the victim. Boys who witness their father's violence are 10 times more likely to engage in spousal abuse in later adulthood than boys who are in nonviolent homes. So today's speakers will discuss the problem, identify successful strategies for both victims and perpetrators who seek help, and focus on what the community at large can do to prevent and treat everyone involved. Rachel Collins, Engagement Manager at Women's Space Incorporated. Women's Space offer a 24-hour crisis line for survivors, a youth program, an emergency safe house program, and other educational and outreach services. They are a part of a statewide network of assistance organizations for women. Thank you for the work you do. And Dr. Joan Davis is a licensed psychologist and author of On Men's Health and Violence Prevention. He is director of the Mackenzie River Men's Center. Their mission is to help men lead healthy lives and reduce violence towards women. Thanks for the many hours you spent doing this. We also have with us today Julie Wiseman, CEO of Women's Space. Thanks for being here today. And with that, I'd like you to welcome our very first speaker, and that's going to be you, Rachel. Okay, please come to the podium.
Thank you all for being here, and thank you to City Club for inviting Women's Space to be part of this forum on an extremely important topic. I've spent the last 2 years at Women's Space, which is considerably less than a lot of the women that work there. I think that I want to honor the decades of work that came before it was even possible for me to work at somewhere like Women's Space, and we're coming up on our 40th anniversary this year. So I think it's a really auspicious and important time for us to be addressing this topic as a community. For those who might be unfamiliar, Women's Space is a nonprofit organization that serves victims and survivors of domestic violence in intimate partner relationships in Lane County. We provide emergency crisis intervention to help victims and their children escape the immediate danger of abusive relationships. This includes a 24-hour crisis line. It includes walk-in hours at our advocacy center where survivors can meet with an advocate in person. It also includes an emergency safe house program for people who are fleeing dangerous situations of domestic violence. But we also provide ongoing support services. So that includes support groups, case management. And where my role in Women's Space falls is a sort of third prong of what we do, which is that we engage in education and outreach efforts to prevent intimate partner violence and to change the circumstances and the structures that create the epidemic of violence we're currently seeing in our community and beyond. So the title of this forum, Cruelty to Women Here and Now, asks us to consider the reality of the situation women face at present in this specific place and time. And through a lot of what I say today, I'm going to be looking at that through the lens of intimate partner violence. That's the specific focus of Women's Space. But I think that a full understanding of this issue is not possible unless we address not just the present reality, but also put it in the context of our history. And to not only address the situation locally, but to put that local situation in the context of the global epidemic of violence against women and of sexist exploitation. So to know where we're going, we have to know where we've been, and that understanding of where we're headed and of the parts we choose to play in that future is an understanding that we need and that we're going to need in order to continue to combat violence against women. So we'll start with what we know. We know that at least one in four women will experience domestic violence in her lifetime, but we also know that domestic violence is one of the least reported violent crimes for a variety of reasons, so it's likely that that number could be higher. We know that this intersects with a variety of other issues. We know that at least one-third in 2014, the latest numbers, of founded child welfare cases in Lane County were domestic violence related. And we know that nationwide, an average of three women are killed by a current or former intimate partner every single day. So I would love to be able to say that we have made strides towards ending domestic violence. I think that that is a goal that we all should have in mind. I think the strides that we have made are very important, but I also don't want to sugarcoat the reality of where we are. It can be really tempting to think of domestic violence as something that happens to other people somewhere else, other countries, other communities, other neighborhoods, and that does not mesh with what we know, which is that this affects everyone. So I want to start by defining our terms and making sure that we're clear about the language that we're using. So intimate partner violence is often also called domestic violence. And this is a pattern of tactics used by an abusive person to gain control over an intimate partner. So this can include isolation, so cutting the victim off from their support networks, emotional and verbal abuse, which is an under-talked about aspect of domestic violence. We have this stereotype that it all is physical. It's all something that you can see from an outside perspective, but we know that that is not true. So degradation, cutting down the victim's self-esteem, gaslighting or undermining their perception of reality, their ability to trust their perceptions, financial abuse, so using money and resources to gain control, not allowing the victim to work or go to school or gain opportunities for independence, constant surveillance and micromanagement, making the victim feel that they're always being watched, that they can't escape the eye of their abuser. Threats and intimidation, so whether that's towards the victim or towards those close to them, often their children, all the way to physical abuse, rape, and too often murder. So contrary to the common misconception, one of the biggest obstacles to my role, which is finding ways to convey this information to the community, is a lot of deeply entrenched cultural myths and misconceptions about what domestic violence is, how it works, and how it affects people. And one of these that I run into very often is the idea that these acts or crimes are arbitrary, they're random, they're the uncontrolled result of someone who can't rein in their anger or their passion or their emotions. And what we know is that this is not true. These are not arbitrary acts committed by people who simply can't control themselves. Sociologist Evan Stark developed the what we call the coercive control model that's widely used by advocates and agencies today. And he created this to put these actions in a context. He established that within a pattern of ongoing coercive control, abusive intimate partners interweave repeated physical and sexual violence with three equally important tactics: intimidation, isolation, and fear. So in other words, the point of that litany of violations or types of violations that I just recited is to affect intimidation, isolation, and fear. And the point of those three factors is to gain control over someone in order to exploit them. So this isn't random, this isn't accidental, this is purposeful, and it's towards a purpose, and that purpose is often very specific and very devastating. So an analogy that really helped me to understand how this dynamic works, it's become a bit of a joke among my staff and coworkers that I will get really excited and nerdy about this analogy whenever I get to bring it up, because I think it's very evocative, and it definitely was a light bulb moment for me in understanding how these tactics affect people and how they become so devastatingly effective. So a feminist author named Marilyn Frey in 1983, which is 6 years after the birth of Women's Space, during a time when there was a huge upsurge in movement and in successes towards creating these services for women, she wrote an essay called Oppression. And in it, she asks us to consider a birdcage. So birds in the birdcage, pretty understandable situation. Bird isn't flying, surrounded by a cage. But imagine that you could only see one wire of the cage at a time. What if you myopically examined one wire at a time, day after day? You would not be able to find anything in that wire, any intrinsic property of that wire, that tells you anything about why the bird can't just fly around it. So you could do that day after day, and you would not find any answer to the question of why isn't the bird flying. However, when you step back, Frey writes, when you step back to gain perspective, you see, and then you see it in a moment, that the reason the bird is not flying is because it's surrounded by a system of interlocking barriers. And this is the case with domestic violence. Those tactics don't work one at a time. They don't work one on their own. They work because they interlock and they intersect. So I want to take that analogy further. This time, let's envision a bird, but the cage is totally invisible to you. Or perhaps you just see one wire encircling the bird. What questions do you have about the situation? What might you assume? And usually at this point, when I'm in a small group, someone will say, well, why isn't the bird flying away? Why doesn't she leave? If it's so bad, why does she stay? Why would anyone put up with that? So maybe at that point, you start to rationalize and explain the situation. Maybe you start to think maybe the bird likes it there. Maybe the bird was always meant to be there. Maybe husbands have an ordained right to control their wives. Maybe the bird can't fly. Maybe women just weren't meant or born to be independent. So we can see how these start to mirror the cultural myths that we tell ourselves both implicitly and explicitly. Maybe the bird was born in the cage and her mother before her. Maybe it's always been this way. And this dynamic is not specific to intimate partner violence alone. When we step back and gain perspective, as Frey wrote it, and take an even broader view, this analogy is just as illuminating when applied to racist exploitation, to colonialism, to poverty, to any other system of power that systematically entraps and exploits its victims. And in fact, poverty, racism, homophobia, colonialism, these other forms of entrenched power form additional intersecting wires that reinforce that cage, depending on who the woman is. Or perhaps they just make that cage smaller, further constraining the motions and the freedom of the victim, depending on her social circumstances. So let's take Frey's advice. Let's step back and gain an even bigger picture beyond just intimate partner violence, beyond just Lane County. So women and girls together account for about 70% of human trafficking victims globally. Women earn 10% of the world's income and own only 1% of the world's land. On average, in the US, women make 77 cents to the dollar, but that number is dramatically lower for Black and Hispanic women. So again, that cage gets smaller the more systems of power you layer onto it. The United States is the only developed country in the world where maternal mortality is on the rise, and Black women in the South are acutely at risk. They are 3 to 4 times more likely to die in childbirth than white women. So a legacy of colonialism and genocide, it lives on in North America in the fact that indigenous women are dramatically more likely to experience violence. And a study came out 2 days ago that from the University of North Dakota that nearly 1 in 3 college men in a study admit that they would commit rape if they knew that there would be no consequences and no one would know. So when we look at these larger and more broad factors that relate to violence against women, we can see that IPV works by those tactics layering together, creating intersecting boundaries. But global sexism works in the same way, and IPV in turn is only one of those wires. A particularly devastating wire, yes, but when we look at the broader context, there are a variety of factors that are affecting the status of women both here and beyond. So this is the reality for women here and now, which this forum is asking us to take into account and to look at. And it's important for me to note that Women's Space does serve men. None of our services are provided exclusively to women. Abuse is just as reprehensible no matter who it is happening to. There are male survivors and they deserve services. To note, however, that the vast majority globally of victims of intimate partner violence and of sex-based violence are female is not to devalue the experiences of male survivors, but to leave that fact out is to obscure the root of the issue. It's to obscure the sexism that influences this issue, and that can effectively cripple our ability to fight it. We need to know where it's coming from. We need to be able to attack the root, and sexism and misogyny are intrinsically a part of that. The UN estimates that of all the women who were victims of homicide globally in 2012, almost half were killed by intimate partners or family members, compared to less than 6% of men killed in the same year, which is a huge disparity. More women have been killed by their male partners since 9/11/2001 than the total number of casualties from the 9/11 attacks combined with the casualties so far from the ensuing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which I realize sounds like an incredibly inflated and exaggerated number, but it's true. Globally, more deaths result from domestic violence than from war. Think about that the next time you hear someone refer to the war on women. Women's Space is a nonpartisan organization. We're a 501c3, but I don't think it takes being a Democrat or a Republican or any particular stripe of party affiliation to notice that male violence towards women hasn't gone anywhere. When the most powerful men in the world brag openly and face no consequences at all for their violation and brutalization of women, when those same men hold the power to make the legislative and funding decisions that affect our ability to defend women, we have our work cut out for us. As I said when I started, I'm humbled in the work that I do to know women who have been doing this work since well before I was born. There are likely women in this room who, unlike me, remember a time before domestic violence services came into being or came widely into being, and I cannot imagine what that was like. When I told my grandmother, who is in her late 80s, that I got this job a couple years back, she got this incredible, almost incredulous expression on her face and told me, "No one used to talk about that." And I feel so lucky to have benefited from the work of women her age and older who have been fighting this since before it was fashionable, since before it was a buzzword, since before we had community forums about it. And I think that to go deeper into that, to think about no one used to talk about that, let's go back to the birdcage. We did not have the language. Those wires were invisible because they were literally unspeakable. And it was women's work, women's consciousness raising, that led to us creating the language around this. The shifts had been massive in the last several decades, but we're not done. Women's Space was begun by a small group of women supporting other women. In the 40 years since Women's Space began, thousands of survivors and their children have been aided, lives have been saved. From a small group of women working out of their homes, lending out spare rooms and couches to women in need, we've become a much larger, more institutionalized organization, but do not let that fool you, because standing with women against misogyny will always be a radical act. We can learn from the bravery of women around the world who face consequences from ridicule and marginalization all the way to physical intimidation and violence in order to do this work. I don't really want to imagine a Lane County where Women's Space never existed, and I don't think that any of us do. Where these services were never available, it would be a very different place. The acts and the alliances of women doing this work in this community that started small have rippled outward over the years to affect our entire community for the better. And the power of that should inspire all of us to act and to participate and to educate ourselves and to hold people in power accountable and to refuse to look away or make excuses for the violence in our community. And I think that we should hold on to that inspiration because we're going to need it. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm John Davies. I'm the director of the McKenzie River Men's Center here in Eugene. First of all, I want to say I've known Women's Space for a long, long time, and I think Eugene, Springfield, Lane County owes Women's Space a huge sum of debt for all the work they've done for all those years, 40 years. Can you think of that? Really amazing. And they've done that work courageously, and they've done it quietly because many of their work is very extremely confidential. So a lot of times we don't even know all the work that they're doing. But I really think, and let's give them a round of applause because they really deserve our support and our ongoing support for Women's Space. What a tremendous job they've done and service they've done to our community. I'd like to change directions a little bit here. How many of you, if you had an opportunity to intervene with some terrorism that was going on here in the United States, how many, without harming yourself, how many of you would intervene against terrorism? Gee, just about everybody in the room would do that. Well, you know what? It's very amazing because women who are experiencing domestic violence often experience it as terrorism. As a matter of fact, Michael Johnson, who's one of the famous researchers on domestic violence, calls a certain type of domestic violence intimate terrorism. When you think about the statistics that Rachel talked about what's gone on since 9/11, you know, all of our resources and energy are focused on enemies external to the United States. Yet, as she pointed out, there's been many more deaths of women in the United States alone. Thousands of women have died since 9/11. At the same time period, there's been hardly any lives lost in the United States of terrorism. Yet, what gets all of our attention, what gets us riled up, is defending our borders, is defending our country from external sources. But we fail to see what's going on right under our noses, which is this tremendous problem of violence towards women. So think about that. I'm seeing a lot of people that look my age out there, and I'm going to ask you a question. How many people remember the song Tom Dooley, the folk song? Okay, a lot of people remember that song. Do you remember what that song was about? You know, I remember, you know, the song Tom Dooley was popular in the late 50s, early 60s by the Kingston Trio, and it was one of the most popular folk songs there. And I never really paid attention to the words, but the words were, met her on the mountain, there I took her life, met her on the mountain, stabbed her with my knife. We never paid attention to that. We smiled and sat around campfires and sang Kumbaya and sang Tom Dooley. And I remember even feeling sorry for Tom Dooley because he was going to be hung the next morning. Somehow the idea that this was domestic violence, and not only domestic violence, it was murder, kind of went over my head. You know, it kind of shows you how we get bombarded with messages and how messages come to us that distort the picture of what is really going on. If we really want to have a safe country, if we really want to reduce terrorism, we need to start here at home with reducing violence towards women. Can you imagine if there was a country that was coming in and killing three of our women a day, how would this country react? We'd be horrified. We would be ready to go to war. We would respond immediately, and we would not rest until the culprits were caught. But the fact that it's not an external source, that it's inside us, inside all of us, that makes us not see and not be willing to act. So I have three fears when I talk about men and violence. My first fear is that people are going to think that I'm bashing men. And I'm not bashing men. I'm a man myself. I've dedicated the last 20 years of my life working with men. And I found that work very, very helpful, and I value it. But I do think that if we're going to end violence towards women, we need to take a look at what's going on with men. The second thing I fear when I speak about violence against women is that other people in the audience are going to, when I talk about possible reasons why men are violent, that they may think that I'm trying to gloss over or justify their behavior. But I want to make it clear, I'm not trying to justify their behavior, but I do believe if we don't learn more about the underlying dynamics of what causes men to lash out against women, then we're going to be stuck in the same place. And the third thing, and Rachel alluded to this in talking about, I also am concerned about possible male survivors being out in the audience. I want to make sure to acknowledge that men can also be victims and survivors of domestic violence and intimate partner violence. Yes, it happens, yes, less, but it's not, that doesn't make it any less damaging when it happens to you or to someone you know. There is nothing inevitable about male violence toward women. We do not have to accept it. We seem to have been lulled to sleep about this. We seem to say, oh, there it happened again, and there's nothing really we can do about it. I want to send you a message. Yes, there are things we can do about it. There are many things. I'm going to jump around here a little bit and talk about most acts of violence in the world are committed by men. Yet the other side of that is that most men are not violent. But one of the scary things and the disturbing things is that the majority nonviolent men feel or believe that because they're nonviolent, they have done their part in ending violence against women. And that is a very unfortunate belief. Because if we were going to make any significant changes in the rates of violence against women, we need to have men on board. And particularly, we need the majority of men, the silent majority, the men who are not violent, to stand up and take action. Now, let's talk a little bit about causes for male violence. And I might have, on some of these, I might have a little different perspective than Rachel, but I think in the larger picture, we're on the same page. Certainly sexism, which has been probably around since the beginning of time, is certainly a cause, or one of the causes, of violence. The second one is social learning. And as Rachel pointed out, that growing up in a household, whether you witness violence, or growing up in a society where violence is expected of you, or you see it on TV, or you see it on the news, or you read about it in the media, these issues can also encourage people to engage in domestic violence. The thing that I focus on is, let's talk a little bit about male power and privilege. There's no question that men in our, and particularly white men in our society, have great power and privilege. However, I also know, due to talking with men every day for the last 20 years, is that most men do not walk around feeling powerful. Most men walk around feeling some degree of being powerless or less powerful. So when we see, and when we talk about, and I agree, that the primary purpose of domestic violence seems to be built around control, about getting control. But I want to ask a further question. Why do some men want that level of control? And you can think about different reasons, but the men I talk to, what I see is the men want that control. And again, I'm not justifying their behavior, but they want that control because they're afraid. That they're afraid. They're afraid of a variety of different things. You know, growing up as a man, there are a number of different issues that are raised very early in men's life, in boys' life. They are taught to be independent, to be aggressive, to be competitive, to be stoic, and to not need help from anybody. That's a very dangerous combination of things. Thank God, a lot of us men, we survive, we find a way to survive that. But for a lot of boys, not having the ability to ask for help is a huge, huge problem. And I believe that this, the other issue is that being a male, being a competent male, is kind of like female body image. It's an unobtainable goal. And no matter what men do, no matter what they achieve, you never feel like you totally get there. And I can tell you from being 67 now, I still don't feel like I've ever gotten there. You know, some days I feel closer than others, but I never truly feel like I'm totally a man. And that's because the standards of manhood are such, they're so perfectionistic and inhuman that it they're impossible to reach. So most men are walking around with some degree of feeling actually inferior, even though they've got to put on a mask that shows they're superior and powerful. Some of the things that men are not supposed to feel are feelings of vulnerability, of dependency. Now, what most men do, since they're taught not to need anybody, is they're actually hungry, very hungry for relationships and connections. And what many men do is they put all their eggs into one basket. Oftentimes, that's a relationship with a woman. So not only is the woman his partner, his romantic partner, she also becomes his best friend, his support network, his counselor, his psychologist, his mother, all these different things. Now, for some of you, that might sound like a very romantic notion, that, but there's great danger in that. And the danger is that one person can't meet everybody's needs, nor should they be expected to. And that's one of the reasons why we try to, at the Men's Center, we try to build broader networks, broader basis of support, where men can come and support each other, where men are not totally dependent on one person or nobody for their emotional support. So how are we doing time-wise here? We're going to talk more about things you can do to prevent domestic violence. We want to encourage everybody in this room to get more involved. Thank you.
Okay, so we also going to have a first questionnaire, and I'm very proud and humbled that Sandra Erickson has graciously agreed to be our first questionnaire. And Sandra taught consumer science on the community college level to women of all ages for 30 years, many who were escaping violence and needing new skills to start over. It has been a life mission of hers to help women achieve autonomy, to lead their own lives without forced control by others. It is my pleasure to introduce Sandra Erickson to ask the first question.
First, let me thank both Rachel and John for words that really moved me. I don't know about the rest of you, but it's a subject that needs to have more words surrounding it. So I originally thought I would ask a question about why, because I think that looms large. But then yesterday in the news, there came the story about the photos in the Marine Corps and the fact that it isn't just the Marine Corps. So my question is, since the United States has pretty much been at war since World War II when I was born, Does the military culture encourage cruelty to women?
I've never been in the military. My dad has been in the military. I was born on a military base. I have not experienced being in the military. So what I want from this answer from myself is to draw on the experiences that have been shared with me from men that I know who have been in the military. A friend of mine is active in Veterans for Peace, another writes widely on issues of masculinity and the military. And I think that work is really valuable, particularly for men to be doing from that perspective. I think that your question, though it doesn't include the word why, is still a why question. Because what we see is that, in effect, the answer to the question you phrased is yes. We see that misogyny and the enactment of misogyny is often, way too often, something that comes out of military culture. So what I want to, I want to zoom past that towards the why. Because again, as John was saying, I do not believe that the vast majority of individual men walking around consciously, specifically, and intentionally want the things that they see happening to the women around them. I refuse to believe that. I have a brother, I have a dad, I don't believe that. What I do believe, however, is that, again, as John was saying, the silent majority of men, whether or not you participate, whether or not you want what happens to the women around you, you are benefiting from it. Because we're talking about situations of class dynamics and power. Power is wielded through classes of people. So when, perhaps, for instance, Marines start a Facebook group where, according to the headline I saw, up to 30,000 of them were sharing violent pornography and illicitly gotten images of the female Marines that were around them, I want to ask why. Because that happens, that we know that happened, in something happened in this case, whether or not we know all the details. But we know that this is not an anomaly. This is not an outlier. This is the norm. Think back to the study from North Dakota that I just talked about, where one in three men that they surveyed would admit to considering sexual assault if they thought they could get away with it. So what that tells me is that there is a deeper issue than just the feelings of individual men. This, to me, gets to the issue of how power is leveraged through groups and what the point of sexism is. I don't think it's a random attitude. I don't think it's a random crime. I think that the statistic I quoted about women making 10% of the income and owning 1% of the land, women do more, dramatically more than 50% of the labor on the planet, and they don't benefit from that. But the other half of the population does. So I think that that's not a complete answer. I'm sort of just pointing to things, but I think that when I look at situations of the military, I want to expand that, and I do want to ask why. And the answer that I can come up with is not the feelings of individual men. It's not individual malice. It is a profit structure. It is a system of distributing resources that systematically privileges and supports the superiority and the supremacy of men at the expense of labor, sex, emotional support, child rearing, reproductive capability, and a variety of other resources that are extracted from women and from the bodies of women. Do you want to follow up, John?
Our military branches have had huge sex abuse, domestic violence problems. These problems have been ongoing. Some units, in a certain time periods, they do a lot of work around this issue, but it keeps reemerging. I think anytime you get large groups of men together and you isolate them, I think you see these types of issues happen. This happened in fraternities on college campuses, happened in a lot of other places. I think the military system probably helps create some of these issues. It exasperates them. It magnifies them. But I'm a little reluctant from the standpoint, one, as I know that the military, in certain branches of the military, have also done a tremendous amount of work to try to head off these issues. And I'm sure it must be frustrating for some of the branches who have spent a tremendous amount of time and resources to address these issues. I also worry that we can signal out different groups of people, the military, fraternities. What we do when we do this is when we say, then that's not me. So by me, I can badmouth the military all day. But that's easy for me to do because then it's me divorcing myself from the problem and saying, I don't contribute to violence against women. It's these other guys, these other groups, the people in the fraternities, the people in the military, the people in these other sick situations. And what I keep looking for, and I encourage you to search your souls, is to think about in what ways do we, each one of us in here, contribute to the problems of violence against women. And not necessarily, you know, yes, we have a problem in the military, and yes, we need to face that. No questions asked. No, but we need to also not just look at other people. We need to look at ourselves.
Thank you both, and the great question from Sandy Erickson. Now, let's break for a couple of minutes to have you formulate your questions. And remember that only City Club members can come to the microphone to ask a question, but those of you who are not members, you can help formulate those questions. So let's come back in about a couple of minutes.
This is KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. We're on Facebook and Twitter and online at klcc.org.
Welcome back to the March 10th City Club program, Cruelty to Women, Here and Now. Support for City Club of Eugene is by members and sponsors, including Jared Dilham. Jared Dilham is a Eugene architect, landscape architect, and planning and urban design consultant. He's also one of our good members that comes every Friday. Thank you, Jerry. The Baker Center for hosting us every Friday, and of course to KPFF Consulting Engineers, partnering with our other professionals to engineer extraordinary places. And thank you for also giving us office space. And member, if you're ready, go right ahead.
Jerry Smith, City Club member. In the 1960s, if somebody was abandoned and hurt and had no income, they could go to welfare, and families, adults, children, all would be protected. It doesn't exist anymore, for a very large part here in Oregon. There's no adult welfare. The welfare for families with children is very inadequate and not consistent. You can be dumped off of it. What is the protection now for somebody who gets dumped by their landlord or their husband or their boyfriend or just goes broke and are hurting? Where do they go?
Richard, you want to do that first? Go ahead.
So when I am, my understanding of what social services are available both here and elsewhere is informed by what we try to refer and provide to the survivors that that get in touch with us. So we often are referring to DHS, who provides the domestic violence grant, which is in some cases a way to get some expenses covered for someone who is fleeing a domestic violence situation. So there are some programs out there that are a help in those cases. But I think your point definitely stands that those are not always adequate. And there, I have definitely had situations on the crisis line answering calls where I reach the end of the rope of things that I can refer someone to. And I have to say, based on my knowledge and the people that I have around me to ask right now and the resources that I know of to look to, I don't know what else to suggest. I'm not sure if any program provides the kind of support that you are that you're needing and that you're reaching out to try to get. So I think that there are definitely some great examples of services that can support both people that are dealing with IPV and in the other situations that you mentioned. However, I think that's definitely an area of work for us as a community, is making sure that those services can be closer to adequate, especially for the most vulnerable people in our community.
Okay, go ahead. You want to add to it? Sure, go ahead.
Jane Smith, City Club member. Oh, I'm sorry, please go ahead.
I just wanted to say real quick that one of the private resources available is Catholic Family Services out in Springfield. They don't cover all the needs, but they certainly have resources. They have food boxes out there, clothing, and they do a lot of important work in the Springfield area.
We also make a lot of referrals to the Mission, to First Place Family Center, and you know there are definitely great examples in our community that I think show a way forward for ways that we can support survivors.
All right, go ahead. Next question.
About 15 years ago, when I was volunteering for Women's Space, judges had been pretty much alerted to the difficulty women had with domestic violence, and almost uniformly referred the men to an anger management class. It was the feeling of people that were working with women that simply gave men another very powerful tool to control the women that they were abusing. Has that situation changed?
There are, I believe there's at least three, perhaps four different better intervention programs that currently exist in Lane County. And I think they've become more sophisticated in the types of services they provide. They have the benefit now of taking a look at 20 years of research in that particular area. And I'm not saying that they're successful 100% of the time, but they've certainly advanced their skills and are not just giving men more tools upon which to manipulate women. And I know what you're talking about, and that was a very serious problem as well. I believe that some of the new better intervention programs have become much more sophisticated and are used for that. Not to say that those situations that you described doesn't occur, but I think it occurs less because of the experience and the research now that's available to these programs.
Okay, next question.
You mentioned that the abusive person often like isolates their victim and does a lot of things to. My understanding is that they're often quite charming people, and they tend to discredit their victim, and so they get them in a position where people don't really believe the victim if something's going on. And I'm wondering if you can, just so people can prevent that kind of situation, what kind of warning signs, like if you're, you know, looking at, you think something's odd going on with loved ones or something, the kind of warning signs you'd recommend to for friends to not isolate them and instead support them?
That's a great question, and I think that you touched on one of the first red flags that I would normally point out, which is isolation, someone becoming less connected with their community, seeming to be, you know, constrained in their actions. I think that I want to emphasize that domestic violence and the red flags that are associated with it can look very different in different situations. I don't think there is one formula for identifying a situation or for knowing what is happening, but I think that what friends and family can effectively do in a lot of cases is if that is a suspicion you have, even if, especially if that person does not seem ready or able to talk about it with you up until that point, making sure that you are a resource, that you know, that they know that you are looking out for them, that you care about them, that you want them to be supported. It can be very difficult to reach out even, and sometimes especially, to someone who's close to you when you're in a situation of that nature. And I think that making it clear to survivors or people that we think potentially might be surviving domestic violence that they are not alone in that situation is one of the most important things we can do, both as family members and friends and as community members as well.
You need to add here? Go ahead.
Sure.
Yes, and I just want to add, I think we need to be careful and not just to have one stereotype about what an abuser may look like. Some of the work that Dr. Johnson is doing is really identifying different types of abuse. He's actually identified four different types of domestic violence that occurs and occur in different ways. And I think if we have one idea about one stereotype about somebody being smooth talking, which may in fact be an important stereotype to have, we don't want to rely on that stereotype alone. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Right. Next question.
Dina Wills, City Club member. I'd like to speak about the women who would never go to Women's Space today, even, because there is such a stigma about saying that your spouse or partner would do a thing like that. University professors, people in that bracket, they don't go for the help. This is many, 60 years ago, I was one of those women who handled it myself for 10 years, and then I asked for a divorce, and it was open season on me, and so he gave up. How do you reach out in this culture to women who would probably rather die than admit that their husband had done what he had done?
Rachel, you want to take that question? Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that's a really important point and an important angle to talk about. And I think that, to me, this is where talking about culture change work, talking about prevention and about raising awareness is a huge part of what we do. Because the more that we can break that stigma, the slogan that we use a lot of the time at Women's Space is end the silence. And I think that as far as strides that we as a culture, as a community, have made in recent decades, that is possibly the biggest one. It wasn't until late in the 1900s, I don't know the specific year, that domestic violence was even mentioned in a medical journal, in a mainstream publication. So when we talk about it at all nowadays, we're demonstrating how far we've come with that. But you're right, there's still so much stigma around it. I think the more that we can normalize the discussion about it, normalize it as a community issue that we are all dealing with, that no one should be dealing with on their own, that people deserve support around, I think that the more we're able to do that, the more we chip away at that wall of silence that still entraps women and others today in terms of not being able to reach out for help. So I think the more we talk about it, the more we can chip away at that stigma.
John, you wanted to add to that? Go ahead.
I just want to add, we may have a stigma in our mind also thinking about that abuse only happens for younger couples. And if it didn't happen early in a couple's relationship, that it's not going to happen. But I think we need to recognize that it doesn't just happen with younger couples, that it happens with couples of all different ages. And there are some things, even particularly some dementia issues, which raises the possibility of domestic violence happening in relationships where they've never seen any domestic violence before during their long relationship. So just something to keep in mind. And you talk about the shame factor, that also may be age-related, that people my age are perhaps caught up more in the shame issue than perhaps some younger folks, although that still exists. But I think we need to be very aware that because we're older does not mean we cannot be survivors of domestic violence, even in a relationship that was formerly not violent.
Okay, we have just time just for one more question, and then we'll need to finish this segment. Go ahead.
My name is Raisa Maddox, representing Capella Market, City Club sponsor since 2014. I think it's become more socially acceptable to raise strong girls to become strong women. I wonder if either of you has any insight into how to raise strong sons who are better citizens to women, both in their lives and in society as a large.
Okay. John, want to go first?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about that. One of the most important things we need to do is to think about what kind of behaviors do we want our sons, our young men, to have. We need to set a new masculine ideals that serve our society. You know, thousands of years ago, the purpose of gender roles was survival of the species. There was a reason why men were taught to be stoic, to be aggressive, and to be independent, because that's what our society needed for men during that time period. What's happened, though, is that now what our society needs from men has drastically changed. And we need to acknowledge that and prepare our young boys and young men for the world that we're currently facing. So, and part of that is involving, we need to get men back involved with raising boys. And that's one of the things we need to work at.
Rachel, do you have anything to add?
I think I want to go back to something that John said during the first question in terms of talking about violence and talking about attitudes around violence as something that occurs everywhere. This is not something where we can scapegoat a specific institution. It's not something where we can scapegoat a specific group. It's something that we need to take accountability for in a larger sense. And I think that in terms of what we can do in raising children, it's not just parents, but also those of us who work with kids. We work with middle and high school and sometimes younger students in programs at Women's Space too, is to localize that and to make it clear to kids and to youth as well that this is something that we don't get to say is out here. We don't get to say it's just one group. It's something that we all have a responsibility towards. It's something that we all have need to have a commitment to if we're going to change that dynamic. And I think that's something that can be universally applied whether we're training, you know, young men or young women.
Before we thank our guests today, there are a few quick reminders and announcements. The City Club is very appreciative of our sponsors, including Evans, Elder, Brown, and Sue Bird, Jared Dillham, Landscape Architect, and KPFF Consultant Engineers. And thank you to KLCC for airing our programs on Monday at 6:30 p.m. and to Community Television of Lane County for broadcasting our recent programs Monday to Friday at noon and Saturday and Sunday. Thank you to Capella Market, a City Club sponsor, and Raisha Maddox for hosting this week's meeting of the course on the local economy that City Club co-sponsors with the Eugene Chamber of Commerce, Lane ESD, and Lane Workforce Partnership. And thanks to the culinary students at Network Charter School, also City Club sponsor, for providing dinner for the course participants in their final class session. This is to identify opportunities for employment for high school students, in case you didn't know. We look forward to seeing you here at the U of O Baker Center next Friday at noon, March 17, for the next week's program. And that's titled, Can Oregon Adapt to Climate Change? Additional information can be found at www.cityclubofeugene.org. Now, let's give a big round of applause to our speakers, Rachel Collins and Dr. John Davis. And thank you to our coordinator and first questioner, Sandy Erickson. My name is Juan Carlos Valle. This concludes today's program.